This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today's show is an encore of a show we did in early October, so we can't get your questions to our panel like usual, but we would still love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Indiana schools are judged in many ways on their graduation rates. When rates are low, so is the school's state-issued letter grade, which can affect enrollment and therefore state funding. But there's a growing concern about school dropouts not having an impact on that rate because they're often counted as homeschoolers. Today, we can't take your questions live, but we do appreciate your questions and comments on social media. We especially want to hear from you if you've had some personal experience with this issue. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining us in the studio now is Dylan Piers McCoy. Dylan has been covering this topic for Chalkbeat Indiana. Thanks for coming in, Dylan.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to join you.
We're also welcoming Candy Bledsoe, a mother from Indianapolis, featured in some of Dylan's recent reporting. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Candy, I want to start with you and what happened with your son. He was a student at Emmerich Manuel High School, and it wasn't going well, as you describe in Dylan's story. During his junior year, you signed paperwork to drop him out. And what happened after that?
He dropped out, but the whole thing that led up to that was the fact that I went in to see where he was as far as what we could do to get him to graduate the following year. And they informed me that he hadn't passed I-STEP since math, since third grade. So that was a concern because he clearly was a junior at that time. And then so I think it just led up to Tyrus believing that he couldn't finish. And then so that led up to the withdrawing part. I never expected for Dylan to knock on my door and then this come about as it did.
So you decided together that you would drop him out, and then you went and did what you thought was exactly that. What did you find out later?
That they are the ones that are in charge to do the paperwork on the front where they mark exactly what it is. And when I got the email of his records, it was homeschooled. They labeled him as homeschool.
And it wasn't labeled like that, so far as you can remember, when you signed the paperwork.
When I signed the paper, it was just my signature, the date. That was it. They didn't take us back, ask, you know, give us any, you know, tell us not to do it or talk us out of it or other options. None of that. It was just I signed a paper like 2 seconds and was out.
What did you think when you finally heard that they had sort of filled in that blank themselves?
I was baffled. I was angry, actually, because when me and Dylan talked, I wasn't aware of the problem, pretty much. So when I was made aware, it was very frustrating.
And you didn't get anything from the school saying, hey, these are your homeschooling, these are your obligations, this is what's expected of you?
No.
Dylan, you've been reporting on the bigger issues around mm-hmm. this for a while. Do we know how much this might be happening around the state, where schools are marking school dropouts as a homeschool transfer?
I mean, I think the short answer is no, we don't know how much it's happening. I can tell you how many students in, say, the class of 2018, our most recent cohort, were labeled as leaving to homeschool. That's about 3,700 students across the state of Indiana. Those students, many of them are clustered at sort of a much smaller number of schools, so they're not evenly distributed. You're not going to find the same number of homeschoolers in every school. And that's how I ended up looking into Manuel, because Manuel has a really high number of homeschoolers relative to the size of the school, to the number of students who are graduating. So you can look at the data now, and you can see schools like Manuel. So just to give you the raw numbers on Manuel, in the class of 2018, the year that we have the latest data for, 83 students graduated and 60 students left to homeschool.
So, in the middle of high school, essentially.
Over the course of that 4-year period, yeah. So these are kids who were supposed to graduate in 2018. 83 of them did graduate, 6 of them dropped out, and 60 of them left to homeschool. So when I was looking at that data, I felt like it was just really stunning, right? And so I wanted to understand what was going on at that school and why they had so many kids leaving the homeschool. That's, I mean, like, That's three kids basically leaving a homeschool for every four kids who graduate. And I've never heard of a school that was like that, to be honest. So you can look at the data now and see schools like Manuel that are real outliers. And Manuel is not unique. I think it's important to understand that there are other schools all across the state where large numbers of students are leaving a homeschool, or things happen like Richmond High School had 48 students leaving a homeschool that year and zero students dropped out. This was a school that used to be labeled a dropout factory. So those things raise questions. And I can't tell you what happened in Richmond. I haven't done reporting there. But you can look at these numbers and say, what's going on at that school? Why are they having so many kids leaving the homeschool? Is there some homeschooling community I've never heard about in southern Indianapolis? But you can't say there, how many of these 3,700 students who leave to homeschool are genuinely being educated at home.
Yeah, those numbers are official, but are they true?
Yeah, I can't tell you that. I know because I found Candy, and she told me the experience that she and Tyrus had about his experience. But I can't tell you what happened to every other kid in his class who was labeled as leaving a homeschool or in other classes, because the state doesn't regulate homeschooling enough to follow up with those kids. You know, the state has relatively lax regulation on homeschooling. So if you withdraw your child to homeschool from high school, the state isn't going to follow up with you and say, are you genuinely educating them at home, or are you essentially letting them drop out? They're not going to follow up with you and say, did you know what you were doing when you signed that form, or did the school label your kid as a homeschooler without talking to you about what your obligations are and ensuring you actually are going to be educating your kid at home. So the severity of the problem is really hard to unpack, because the problem is that we're not collecting enough data, that we're not following up with these kids. We're letting them sort of disappear from our rolls.
But what effect does it have for the school to have a record showing someone went to homeschool as opposed to dropping out? There's got to be a benefit to them.
Yeah, it can have real benefit. There are real incentives in place, honestly, for schools and for families to say that a student who is leaving high school is leaving a homeschool. So the incentives for the school is about the graduation rate, like you pointed out at the beginning. So the way the state calculates its graduation rate is basically you take the number of students who graduated and you divide that by the number of students in the graduating class. And the graduating class includes groups like students who drop out and students who are still in school. But for students who leave to homeschool, they're completely removed from the calculation. So they basically disappear from the numbers. So at a school like Manuel, for example, those 60 students didn't earn high school diplomas. But they're not part of the graduation rate calculation at all. So if for 2018, the graduation rate at Manuel was 78%, right? If you were to count all of those students who left to homeschool as dropouts, the graduation rate at that school would fall to 50%. And even if you just counted some of them, if you count one third of them as dropouts, the grad rate falls to 66%. Right? This has big implications for schools. For a school like Manuel, they're really under pressure to improve their graduation rate. So being able to remove a kid from that calculation and not get dinged for a dropout can really boost your grad rate and make you look a lot better.
Have you heard from school officials? And if so, what are they saying when they're asked about this?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to many school officials across the state. So the folks at Charter Schools USA, which runs Manuel High School, told me that they aren't mislabeling students as leaving to homeschool. They wouldn't talk about specific student cases for privacy reasons. So they don't have a response to Candy specifically, but they said they only label people as leaving a homeschool when the parents want to withdraw that student to homeschool. And that when a student wants to leave, they talk them through all their options. And this is really, really a parent choice. And it's being led by the population they're serving, having a lot of students who might need to work to support their family or might get, you know, pregnant in high school. And that's why they have so many students leaving to homeschool.
Candy, if you're comfortable talking about it,
What were some of the biggest issues that led to your decision to pull your son out of school? Do you know why he was having such a tough time?
Tyrus has ADHD and some other things going on. The therapist throughout the years have worked with him on coping skills. One of them was headphones, playing music, and he could just zone. Like, there's a year, probably his sophomore year, where he was doing so great because Miss G was there. She never really – they still talk to this day, him and Miss G. She just left Manuel. But he had a lot of issues with the teachers. Some teachers would allow the headphones. Others would not. So when he went into the next year, they were like – calling me every day, can you come get him? Can you come get him? He's refusing to do work because the headphones weren't in play.
What was your plan for him when you signed the paperwork to have him drop out? Your intentions were to drop him out. And then what was the plan after that?
Because the bad grades, he couldn't get a job while he was in high school. So that was the plan.
Get a job.
Yeah, and work.
Dylan, we have about a minute. The state takeover of some low-performing schools in Indiana, there's a complicated story there that goes back to 2012. It's a factor in this specific story. Since Manuel was one of those schools, does the unique setup at these schools kind of have an effect on this issue, or does it seem to be happening everywhere?
I would say a little bit of both. Manuel was taken over by the state because of low performance. It's being run by an operator called Charter Schools USA out of Florida. And I think what's notable about that is that this was a school under immense pressure to improve and to show improvement in its graduation rate. And that's true of schools that were taken over by the state, but also other schools that are just sort of on notice, schools that have struggled and that really state officials and others are really looking to see them improve, right? So, and it's also a school that is facing a lot of problems, right? This was a school that got taken over by the state. It wasn't a school that was doing well to begin with. So this is happening all across the state, but definitely more clustered, I'd say, at schools that are really struggling and are facing other challenges.
Thank you both for talking with us. Dylan Piers-McCoy, reporter for Chalkbeat Indiana. Candy Blesdo, the Indianapolis mother featured in Dylan's recent article. Can you both stick around for the next segment?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We'll bring in two new voices to talk about the bigger picture and the ongoing debate about Indiana's regulations or lack thereof around homeschooling. Should the state do more to track kids who are homeschooled, or do certain regulations infringe on your rights as a parent? I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in a minute and a half, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get back to today's show on school dropouts and homeschooling in Indiana, I want to tell you about yesterday's show on the Red for Ed rally along those lines. We talked to union leaders, teachers, and our education reporter to find out what teachers want from the state lawmakers this year. You can find a podcast of all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Today we're playing an encore of our show on hidden school dropouts in Indiana. There's growing concern from some that schools are marking dropouts as homeschool transfers, which boosts the school's graduation rates. We can't get your questions and comments to our panel today, but we would still love to hear what you think on this issue. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we welcome back Dylan Piers-McCoy, a reporter at Chalkbeat Indiana, who's covering this story, and Candy Bledsoe, the mother featured in Dylan's recent feature story and whose son was incorrectly marked as a homeschool transfer earlier this year. We're joined now on the phone by Tara Bentley. Tara is executive director of the Indiana Association for Home Educators. Hi, Tara.
Hi.
Also on the phone, Dr. Rachel Coleman. She's executive director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Rachel, we'll start with you. Can you start out by explaining what the Coalition for Responsible Home Education is?
Yes, we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We advocate for homeschooled students across the country. We were actually founded by homeschool graduates, and we advocate specifically for the needs of homeschooled students in a variety of areas, This topic that you're discussing on the show is actually very timely because it's something we are working on increasingly based on some really interesting data in Kentucky where they found a spike in homeschool transfers after the compulsory attendance age was raised from 16 to 18 and other issues suggesting that the population that is homeschooling is in high schools is sort of a very specific population in need of a specific sort of support. So this is definitely something that I can speak to that we're seeing on a national level.
We've been talking about this specific issue with schools marking students as homeschool transfers when that might not be true. Have you seen issues like this in other places?
Yes, we have seen this in states across the country. As I mentioned, we've seen it in Kentucky, but we've also seen it in Texas and in Florida, among other places. And also, back in 2008 or 2009, this was an issue that cropped up in Delaware County, Indiana, when I was doing some research there. I was actually studying at Ball State University at the time, and there were schools there that were having astronomically high homeschool transfer rates and, you know, single-digit dropout rates that led to quite a bit of reporting at the time. So this is a long-term problem that is not in any way new.
What about the issue of regulations and record-keeping on homeschoolers? How does Indiana compare to other states in that department?
It's really on the bottom. There is no requirement to even notify anyone that a family is homeschooling. So the state does not have any records of how many students are homeschooled or of who is homeschooled. There's no check-in. So if you do homeschool in Indiana, you really are on your own, which works out fine for parents who are prepared and who go and find the resources they need. But to give you an example, I had a neighbor in Bloomington, Indiana, several years back who was pushed by her public high school to homeschool her son because he had anxiety and other mental health issues. She was a single mom who worked full time. She didn't actually have the time to put into educating her son, but at the school's behest, she pulled him out, marked him as homeschooled, and he just lost a whole semester because he just sat at home and did nothing while she was at work. So there isn't any extra support there for families who need the support as a result of the complete lack of oversight in the state.
Tara, you're executive director of the Indiana Association of Home Educators. Can you describe what that group is and where they stand on how Indiana handles regulations?
Yes, our group was formed in 1983. We're a nonprofit that works to support, encourage, and protect homeschool families. We do whatever we can to come alongside families, help them be successful, help them get connected with local resources along the way. And we've been doing this for over 30 years. I would say with regulations, we highly value the freedom that we have because what we know is that overwhelmingly regulation doesn't really change the face of homeschooling at all, from high regulation states to low regulation states. So what Rachel said, though, I really want to highlight because I think it is so important when she's talking about Kentucky and the compulsory school age. You know, when you take that knowledge and you apply it to the numbers that Dylan has shared, 3,700 kids left the public school in Indiana. So a third of them were seniors. So these high school seniors, these kids who are 17 and 18, are overwhelmingly the numbers of kids that these schools are mislabeling. And I think that's really what we have to look at.
What are some of the main reasons that parents decide to homeschool in Indiana?
There's a lot of reasons why families start from the beginning, and I think very often the reasons that they may transfer their child from the public school are often very different. Overwhelmingly, we're seeing a lot of kids with special needs whose their needs are just not being met in the school system, and they're looking for alternatives. Obviously, we know that school violence is on the rise, bullying within the schools is on the rise, and families want a safe alternative for educating their children, and homeschooling has a proven track record.
Rachel, you've done research on this and looked into the history of it. Have the reasons parents decide to homeschool changed over the years?
Yes. Early on, actually the very earliest homeschoolers in the 70s tended to be on the left. They tended to argue that schools constrain children and that children needed to be sort of free to be in the world and learn naturally. Sometimes that method is called unschooling. In the 80s, the demographics sort of changed as you had a lot of evangelical and fundamentalist parents begin homeschooling in order to provide their children with a Christian education, especially in areas where Christian schools weren't available or where the family didn't really have the finances for Christian schooling. But since 2000, we've really seen that open up. We've seen the reasons that parents homeschool really get broader. And a piece of that is that homeschooling is seen today less as a radical choice and more as just one more piece of a wider climate of school choice, so that parents have so many different options. I actually wrote a dissertation in 2010 where I called this population of homeschoolers pragmatics, those who homeschool for more pragmatic reasons. But there was another researcher, Jennifer Lois, who termed them second-choice homeschoolers. And I think that is a really interesting terminology because she differentiated between first-choice homeschoolers, those who always intended to homeschool, came to homeschooling for very specific reasons. This is part of their ideology and the whole way they raise their children. And on the other hand, second-choice homeschoolers who initially tended to have their kids in school but removed them to homeschool for sometimes their child had mental health issues, sometimes there was bullying, sometimes special needs that weren't being addressed. Whatever the reason was, they then pulled their kids to homeschool after not initially attending to homeschool. And so that's where her term second-choice comes from. And I think we see that a lot more today, where probably close to half of those who homeschool are doing so for these pragmatic reasons, as opposed to having started off, individually intending to homeschool. And it's interesting, I'll just add one more thing, with the Kentucky data, half of all homeschool transfers in Kentucky are among high school students. We don't have similar data to look at in Indiana, in part because, as I said, we don't actually have an overall count of how many students are homeschooled, and this information is not collected at the state level, even in terms of the overall number of transfers. So in Kentucky, though, half of the students transferred to homeschool are in the high school years, and in any given year, as many as a third of homeschooled high school students are new homeschool transfers who've been homeschooling for less than a year.
Dylan, you heard from someone in your story who was both a teacher and a parent of a student at Manual, that the school actually pressured him to take his son out to homeschool him after his son got into some trouble. Does this seem like a common thing? Have you heard it from anybody else?
Yeah. In that case, actually, the school pressured him to sign a form withdrawing his son to homeschool at a time when his son was not in the school or even at home. His son had run away. So he didn't know where his son was, and he didn't sign the form for that reason. He said pretty clearly, like, I'm not homeschooling because I don't know where he is. I did hear variations on that from other folks, not people that ended up being willing to go on the record for the story, but I did talk to people who had had experiences where they had their child had problems in school, and the school said, oh, you know what would be better for your child? They're not doing well socially, or they've been getting in fights. What could be better for them is if you homeschool them. And they weren't people that had wanted to homeschool or were equipped to homeschool, you know? So
it's a huge responsibility.
Mm-hmm. I have heard from folks who had similar experiences. This is a very hard population to find. So I know there are people with stories out there that we haven't heard from yet, because it's really hard to find people who have left to homeschool but aren't actually engaged homeschoolers, you know, not the same kind of people that you would meet at a homeschool co-op or something like that.
Tara, are you worried about schools doing this, pushing for parents to homeschool as a way to get rid of students who are tough to deal with?
Absolutely. This is something that we have talked about as an organization and with our team for many, many years. We're very concerned about our community kind of being lumped in with these families based on a broken withdrawal system for the schools and a broken accountability system for the schools. These school ratings, the pressure on these schools to perform, and as Dylan said, there's a reason that you see these skewed numbers in struggling districts. They're under great pressure to perform, and I just think it's leading to some bad choices and a bad system. And it's not reflective of the homeschool community at large. and I think it's very important. We're very grateful to Dylan for doing what she did. We've been talking about this for a long time, but we didn't have the same stories because by the time families come to us, they are going to homeschool. They want to know how to do it. They want to do the right thing for their child. And what Dylan was able to do was to highlight, you know, find some cases where this was not true. And we're grateful for her opening up this conversation to a larger audience.
Dylan.
I think one thing that was interesting that I heard from Tara and from other people in the homeschool community is that they do sometimes hear from families who've been sort of pushed out of schools and are looking for help with homeschooling, people who didn't intend to homeschool or want to leave to homeschool. And they will show up sort of they will be in homeschooling communities. And every once in a while, they will be reaching out to advocates and saying, OK, I've been told to homeschool. How do I homeschool? What am I supposed to be doing? And so I thought that was interesting. I started looking at this because of the impact on graduation rates, which I think is really important. But it's a story that actually I think homeschoolers have heard more about and been aware of for a longer time than some other folks.
Colleen from Facebook writes in, I was homeschooled in Indianapolis from kindergarten through eighth grade. I had a wonderful education. I was educated by my mother, who had an education degree and who approached her our education as her full-time job. I know that's not everyone's experience, but it certainly was mine. The only negative elements of my homeschool education were the ignorant things people said to me and my family about homeschooling. And Zan from Facebook writes, with no oversight, how do we ensure kids are actually being educated to Indiana standards? Tara, I'll turn this to you. From my experience and from the work that we've done looking into all of this, the parents who are really doing it, who are really homeschooling, are taking it seriously, and it is a huge responsibility. Does this sort of resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. Our families are choosing to homeschool. They sacrifice a lot to educate their children at home. And, you know, whether there's regulations or not, they want to do what is best for their child because they love their child. That's why we do what we do. That's why we sacrifice and make the decisions that we make. I was absolutely one of those pragmatic homeschoolers, I think, as Rachel referred to. I was never going to be a homeschool parent. My daughter was in the public school system through sixth grade before we made the decision to homeschool, and I did think it was going to be a temporary measure for us. I didn't think I was capable of doing it through high school, but we did. And there's a lot of families who come into homeschooling without the same commitment that many other families do, but they can still be successful. And I think that's important to realize.
What about what Zan said about no oversight and ensuring that kids are actually being educated to Indiana standards? I know that the homeschooling community in Indiana has enjoyed a lot of freedoms. And perhaps, I would say probably, I would assume that you probably don't want any more regulations, but it seems like with more light on this issue, that might come down the road. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, we do have regulations. We are required to keep attendance, but more importantly, we're required to provide our children with an equivalent education. And there are educational neglect laws already on the books. And there are ways for the superintendent and the schools to meet with the family if they feel they're not doing what they need to do. And additional regulation is not really going to help that. We have the laws already on the books. We are private schools, and yes, we can choose what standards to use for educating our children, just like any other private school. But there are laws on the books to already deal with these situations.
Rachel, we hear a lot nowadays about mental health issues, anxiety issues with young people in school, whether it's happening more or we're just better at identifying it. Is that a big part of this? Are some schools just unequipped to deal with complicated problems?
I think the schools, in some cases, choose not to become equipped because it's easier, as has been discussed, to just sort of get rid of the problem by pushing a family to transfer to homeschool. You know, problem out of sight, out of mind. When what schools really need to be asking is, what are they doing that isn't working for all of their students and how can they change that? Whether that's creating more flexible systems or having more counselors or something to meet these kids' needs, they have a responsibility to be doing that and in many cases are not currently meeting these needs. I would add one thing. There are some very interesting programs in Alaska that we would like to see replicated in more states.
In Alaska, families can enroll in programs that provide them with $2,000 per child in education-related funding as reimbursements for education expenses such as tutoring, classes, and other things like that. These programs, they operate by, they receive the state funding allotment. They're often run by school districts, sometimes by charter programs, and they have certain obligations and responsibilities to the students. So each family meets with the program operators to create an education plan at the beginning of each year. The family still chooses the curriculum. In some cases, they can choose an online program or other programs that have even more hands-on help, or they can just put it together from different curriculum providers and more, you know, do-it-themselves approach. They turn in quarterly progress reports. They have a teacher assigned to each family that they have to have contact with monthly just to touch base, see how things are going, provide some support. Many of these programs have an enrichment center, which offers additional programming, tutoring, arts programming. The students are also allowed to participate in any public school offerings, including extracurriculars or individual classes. So if they wanted to take an individual, you know, ceramics class at the high school or chemistry because, you know, they may not want to find the lab equipment for their home, they can take them through the high school at no cost. And then at the end of the year, they have the students tested just to see what their progress is like, and that helps inform the family and helps inform the teacher assigned to the family. And again, the family receives the funding. These programs
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it at that. We're running out of time, but I do want to thank everyone for taking the time with us today. That's totally fine. Dylan Pierce-McCoy, reporter for Chalkbeat Indiana, thank you for coming in. Candy Bledsoe, thank you for sharing your story. On the phone was Tara Bentley, Executive Director of the Indiana Association of Home Educators. Thank you for calling in. And Dr. Rachel Coleman, Executive Director of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. Thank you, Rachel. Up next, my conversation with State Representative Bob Boehning. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. For more on this issue of Indiana high school dropouts being counted as homeschoolers, we're joined by Republican State Representative from District 91 and Chair of the House Education Committee, Bob Boehning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So the first thing we're talking about here is the concern that students in Indiana who leave to be homeschooled haven't factored into graduation rates at all. Was it intentionally made to work that way, or how did it happen?
Well, I think one of the – I mean, it's been that way historically for some time. The reality is that we have a very robust homeschool community in the state of Indiana. And in general, most homeschool parents are very focused and interested in doing what's in the best interest of their son, daughter, or child. And so as we developed our graduation rate many years ago, we thought that it made sense if you left to go to homeschool. That was – it wasn't a dropout. It was actually moving from one education choice to another. And in many cases, that is the case. What we've found in some of the most recent reports is that we have a significant issue in secondary, especially in 11th and 12th grade, with students exiting for that code.
But at issue here is that some of the parents don't know what they're signing, essentially. They don't know that they're signing their children out of school for homeschool. They just think that they're officially dropping them out.
As I said, this has been a problem that just didn't happen last year. We have attempted in General Assembly. We've worked with the Homeschool Association over the years. I'm an advocate of quality homeschool opportunities for students and for parents. So we've worked with them and tried to go after this a number of ways. Unfortunately, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. It seems like you put one place here and then all of a sudden it doesn't seem to have the impact, or something pops up there. So several years ago, we did require principals to have a form that would share with parents when they choose to pull their son or daughter out to homeschool. It would share with them what the expectations are. Homeschool is not, and for those parents who are committed to it, they will openly agree with this. Homeschool is not playtime or, you know, time for my son or daughter to be off. It's time I'm going to spend time educating my child and providing what they would have received in a school. So what we try to do in the initial form is say, hey, you know, you decide to homeschool. These are the obligations under state law. You have to provide them. Here's the curriculum. Here's the standards. You know, these are obligations that you have. We tried, like I said, a variety of different issues. This past session, we had a lot of discussion on virtual education. There's been a lot of criticism, rightfully so, aimed at some of our virtual schools because they haven't been meeting the needs of students. I also hear from virtual educators who tell us that a significant number of their students show up in 11th and 12th grade and they come credit deficient, not on target for graduation, so which has a negative impact on them as well. So we're trying to figure out what my whole focus and our whole focus has been is what's the best solution for students, not necessarily systems. Let's forget the systems and try to focus on making sure students get the opportunity that they get a high school diploma, which is a minimum. It's not really the maximum that's going to be necessary for success in life. And so, you know, the form that we had them sign, we had principals involved. We were hopeful that would work. And unfortunately, it appears that many times I'm called into the office. I'm a parent. I'm handed a form, say, sign this. And they may think they're signing their son or daughter out to drop out, but they've actually signed them out to be a homeschool parent, unaware of the fact that there are some responsibilities that come with it.
Let's talk about those responsibilities and regulations, too. How much regulation is there on homeschooling in Indiana?
Indiana is a state that has no regulation on homeschools. We have expectations. In general, if you look at homeschool students, they generally outperform our traditional schools, charge schools, private schools, especially when they get to post-secondary options. Our homeschool parents take it very seriously. Unfortunately, what happens, as I said earlier, there are requirements that when you decide to homeschool, expectations the state has to make sure that you are providing educational services for that child. Unfortunately, I think many times this form's put in front of someone and not totally explained to them exactly what those specific details entail. I know that I frequently talk to superintendents about this, especially when I were able to identify where pockets of problems are and suggest to some administrators, I think you've got an issue here. You need to be driving down on this. This is a problem. And several school districts have shared with me that they, you know, when a parent makes that decision, they hand them the textbooks that are appropriate for that child and say, here, you know, you're now taking this responsibility to educate your child, and here are the textbooks that go along with the program that you're enlisting or basically signing yourself up for.
Really quickly, before we get to Senate Bill 567, do you think that this, if it sort of catches fire in sort of a negative way, that this could put a stain on the homeschool community and sort of maybe ruin that good reputation that they've had because these numbers sort of appear the way they do?
I think that the homeschool community, at least my conversation, I haven't had any in the last several months, but over the iteration of all the things we've tried to do to adjust this, make sure this is meeting the needs of students in a better way, the homeschool community has actually been very supportive of actions that would make sure that homeschool is being provided by adults and parents who really have a passion to serve their child, as opposed to being a action that is, you know, a reaction to somebody else saying you should do this.
So that distinction needs to be clear in the public eye.
I do not think this is not a condemnation at all of homeschool and the quality of homeschool, which is why I would shy away from regulations. I think the issue is more what's happening in our high schools and why are they handing a paper to a parent saying you need to homeschool. I think anybody would have to openly admit that if I have a passion and commitment to do it and it's something I want to do, I'm going to do it a lot better job at it as opposed to somebody saying, here, you have to do this. And most of the time when they say you have to do it, they're not prepared. Many of these parents are single parent households, have no ability to provide that type of supervision. If you ask any homeschool parent, I think they'll tell you that it's not an easy job. It's a lot of work. I have my sister homeschooled several of her kids. One of my colleagues at work has four daughters, and they're being homeschooled. It is a lot of work, and so it's not something somebody takes casually.
Let's talk about Senate Bill 567, which you were a sponsor on. How did it hope to improve this issue when it was written?
Well, 567 was really focused on virtual charter schools and or on virtual education, not just charters, but virtual education of all sorts. So we did start to recognize that we're having some significant problems with virtual education. We want to make sure that there's everybody doing that with fidelity. If you look at the education landscape, you start looking at the world we live in terms of employment. There's more and more of our services are being provided online, and there's webinars, all sorts of instructional programs are done online. So it's natural to think that some of our school options would be a virtual option. And when they originally started, they were a lot of times were kids who may have been in athletics. It would have required them to do a lot of traveling. It was one way to keep them focused and keep them up to and current and at grade level. It could be, I remember, especially when we did the initial bill, we had a couple parents whose kids had significant allergies, and one was allergic to wood, if you can imagine that. So even picking up a pencil was where they would have a huge allergic reaction. Sitting in a room of desk, if they had wood in the desk, that caused problems. So they ended up choosing to put their child in a virtual education system because it was just out of safety for their child and concern for their child's well-being. But what has happened over time is that a lot of it's being abused, and they're not. Some schools, and when I say abused, I mean it depends on the system. I know that there are several school districts that run their own virtual programs, and sometimes they use them for credit recovery. So they recognize that I'm not on track to graduate, so maybe and I'm not being successful in a brick and mortar school. Maybe a virtual option would be more logical for a student, but they're not using it to change accountability or to improve graduation rate, because it is inside their own school district, and therefore if that student doesn't graduate, it still has an impact on their grad rate.
567 was passed, but it changed quite a bit before it did. What happened to it? Was it compromised, do you think it was, or do you think the changes that were made were the right ones?
Well, there were a lot of things in 567. There was a companion bill. I had a House Bill 1172. We decided they were both somewhat similar. We decided to merge the two of them. We put more regulations on virtual programs, for instance, making sure that at the beginning that there's an engagement policy and a acknowledgement by parents that they understand by enrolling in this program, I am assuming the responsibility that I am, the virtual program will provide the curriculum and instruction, but I, as the adult in the room, are going to be responsible for making sure that my child is engaged. I mean, that was one of the functions. We also added that they had to have software that would demonstrate that a student is actually engaged. So you couldn't just turn on a computer monitor, walk away, and go play some video game while, and not receiving. I mean, they have, and there's technology today that would be able to demonstrate by, the responses to questions whether or not that student is engaged. So we had engagement policy as far as that was concerned. We allow our virtuals now to, if a student fails to be engaged, they can now say, I'm no longer providing educational services for this child because this child, even though has enrolled, has chosen not to really be involved in the programming. So we're not going to allow that. We put more accountability standards in around all of that. And then we dropped in language in the House dealing with grad rates. And we had it had come through Education Committee, had a lot of discussion in Education Committee. I had provided all the committee members the data that I had gotten from DOE, which would show, how these students were leaving. Many of the students were leaving in the last – well, you know, in Indiana, we up until this budget cycle, we had a single count date, and the count date is in September, and schools are funded based on the count date. So if you look at where these students would exit, many of them would exit after the count date. There's also a second count date in early part of the year that is a square up kind of count date. It wasn't used for actual funding, but some of them would leave after the second count date of their senior year. So they're leaving basically second semester of their senior year to homeschool. I mean, logically, there may be cases where a parent has, you know, maybe safety issues, maybe they're concerned about their child in some way, but most that have a massive exodus just doesn't make logical sense. And then we also, we've done some tracking to find out where they were in terms of credits. To graduate from high school, you need to generally approximately 40 credits to graduate, and many of these were well below what would have been necessary to graduate even with the 40 credits. When we looked at 11th and 12th grade, so both of those grades, they were, many of the students were credit deficient. So it appeared that there was obviously, unfortunately, maybe some intention for these students to kind of go off of the system, and let's use code 20, which is homeschool, in an effort to improve that. We actually, at House Ed Committee, as I recollect, and I'm fairly certain I'm correct on this, we actually voted in the committee to say that if you exit for code 20, which is homeschool, you are considered a dropout. Mm. So it would just have eliminated it as an option totally.
Because it seems like there's incentive for these schools to sort of make that happen.
Correct.
Because otherwise it becomes the dropout rate.
Correct.
Which is not good for them.
And the grad rate became very important under No Child Left Behind as a federal law, because the feds started saying we need to have some more accountability. We're giving states, Indiana gets about $650 million a year in title money. We need to make sure that title money is being focused and being used for students and really trying to close the achievement gap. Under Every Student Succeeds Act, which was a replacement for No Child Left Behind, the original language in the bill actually said that grad rate had to be calculated, and it's outlined how it had to be calculated, and it actually said that a student would be counted a dropout unless they went to another school that was a diploma-granting institution. Under most state law, homeschool cannot technically award a diploma. So they would theoretically be a dropout under federal accountability. However, the feds, when they promulgated the rules, decided that they would let homeschool. So we thought we had federal government had stepped in and had it fixed. And if we were going to have a grad rate aligned with our federal grad rate, which is what we don't want to have two grad rates, one state grad rate, one fed grad rate. We thought we had it fixed. But then this new advisory comes out and says, well, we're going to allow homeschools to be the a diploma granting institution. So it kind of blew that as an option. So when it left the committee, we actually said, you exit for homeschool and secondary, you're considered a dropout.
There's a lot more to unpack here, and I wish we had the time for it. So I'll give you the last word here. What's the main thing you hope to change at this point to make this situation better?
My primary focus, and I hope it is of everyone, is that we want to do what's best for kids. Coaching someone out or suggesting someone go to a homeschool environment, virtual environment, when they are already behind in a brick-and-mortar environment, unless the person who is responsible for this child understands the implications of what they're signing up for, is not something that's acceptable. We have to do what's right for kids. And honestly, these kids need to have wraparound services, need to have more services, not less. And so I think it's a big mistake. So the goal would be to change that behavior and try to focus more on doing what's right for kids and providing the educational services they deserve.
Republican State Representative from District 91 and Chair of the House Education Committee, Bob Boehning, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us tomorrow for our show on ethics in technology and some of the studies being done in Indiana on the topic. As always, keep up with us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same frequency. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.